welcome to the Drawn Today podcast, where we encourage you to draw every day. On today's episode, Color Theory 101, or as we like to call it, Color for Dummies. Today on the Drawn Today podcast, we have four members of the Drawn Today blog. Let's start off with Alan.
AlanDouglasStudio.com.
And new to the podcast, Kim Kincaid.
ArtByKimKincaid.com.
And Madeline.
Madeline Carol Matz at MCMatz.com, MCMATZ.
And I am Mark Harchar at Harchart.com, HARCHART.com. Well, today's podcast, we want to talk about color. I don't know about the rest of you guys, but it's been one of my nemesises ever since I started painting. So let me ask the group this. What are your initial thoughts on color? Do you like it? Do you dislike it? Are you comfortable, not comfortable? Where do we stand on this?
I think a lot of artists, some tend to lean towards black and white, especially starting out. I've never been that way. I've kind of always jumped into color, and it's never kind of been a problem for me. Over the years, obviously, I learned to handle it a little better. What do you guys think?
Well, I guess I'm a lot like most people who kind of come at art through graphite, you know, through pencil, and got very comfortable in seeing value. And so it has been a real struggle for me in understanding color. And I'm with you, Mark. I'm quite intimidated by color, but I'm determined to figure it out. And because I'm pulled toward those things that are done in those beautiful color palettes.
I've also had a love-hate relationship with color. I started off, again, really strongly in black and white, having grown up with a black and white television, and my father had a lot of books with ink drawings in them and stuff, so I never had a lot of exposure to color images when I was younger. So doing a lot of ballpoint pen work and, you know, all over my papers and stuff, I always prefer doing the black and white work, and the color is intimidating because it's a whole different thing.
I know myself personally, I've always been drawn to a limited range of colors just as far as my own aesthetic likes, and it tends to be very almost monochromatic, earth tone type of color palettes, and those are a lot easier to manipulate and deal with. It's almost like working in black and white to a degree, because there's a smaller range, and dealing with bright, garish, all types of different colors that can have temperatures and you know, multiple hues ranging across the spectrum. It's a little intimidating to me, and I'm still trying to figure out how to work those into my work.
So, Mark, what colors do you actually use in your oil painting?
I started out with a palette that was very much almost old master-like, where there was a lot of umbers, siennas. I started out using flake white, which was a very transparent white, but I didn't like the lead in it, so I kind of got away from that a bit. But
you know, they do have lead replacement white out there now.
Does it have that same sheen to it? Because I've worked with lead white, and there's a certain finish to it that you can't really get with like the titanium white and the zinc white.
Oh, I don't know, because I didn't mean to interrupt there, Mark, but for a class I just took, a workshop, that he actually said you need to bring this replacement. So because I hadn't worked with flake before, I don't know by comparison. But Alan, have you had any experience with that? Or
I've always used titanium white, and really it's always worked for me. To be honest, when I get into the whites or the blacks, I know there's slight differences between the whites. One might be a little warmer, one might be a little cooler, but I don't see that much difference. Unless you're doing like a really white painting where the subtleties are super important, I don't even think it comes into play so much. Yeah, I think you guys are actually kind of coming from a good point, being starting out in black and white, because as we all know, the most important aspect of any color you choose is its value. So if you can nail the value of it first, then your piece will hold together. You know, I always desaturate my pieces so I can see if they hold together in black and white, because that is the most important thing.
Well, you bring up a good point there with the value of colors, because I am very comfortable at this point working in value. And in most of the pieces that I start, whether it's digital, you know, graphite or even oil, I generally start with a value painting, a value study. And I'm pretty comfortable in getting that all worked out, getting the proper range of values in an image. Yet to translate a color into a value is one of those hurdles that I seem to have trouble with. And I sat down at the IMC this year with Boris and Julie to talk about color specifically, because, well, you have to admit, you look at their paintings and they have every color on the planet in there, and it's so cohesive. But one of the
things more interesting too.
Yeah, it does. And one of the things that I had mentioned to them was that I always hear people talking about, especially when we're talking skin tones and things, because inanimate objects seem to be a little easier for me, but the transparency, the translucency of skin tones and all the different colors that you can get in a skin tone throws me off so much that I hear people talking about, well, you know, I see these purples in the shadows and I see the, you know, these oranges and yellows in the light areas. And to be honest with you, I don't know that I see those colors. And it's not that I'm colorblind or anything. It's just I can't differentiate. Do other people see that?
Well, I think it's a very subtle thing. And I don't know if you're talking about working from a photo or a live model.
Oh.
But a lot of it is just – it's kind of livening up the color, you know. It's breathing some life into it that maybe it's there. Maybe it's so subtle. But, I mean, Frazetta was great at that. He would just really saturate it and bring – you know, extraordinary life into his skin tones.
I think basically almost any area that you're painting, you can almost put any color in it to a certain degree. I had a teacher in high school at night school. I was going to took a night class when I was in high school, and he basically said that especially in flesh tones, there's like every color in it. And I think you can train yourself. It's like when you're doing a pencil drawing and you the more you look at something, you see more and more the subtle gradations within a shadow. Like a shadow you thought was one color, the longer you look at it, you start to see more of the subtle changes. And it's kind of the same thing with color. And especially with flesh tones, you really can throw a turquoise green and a blue and purples and yellows. And that's going to keep the flesh color livelier. In that piece I just finished, I did a book cover with a hand on it, and I had all kinds of crazy colors in there. Just because that's what helps you give it shape. You know, you use the cool colors to turn the shadows and the warm colors to bring it forward.
Well, I think the important thing, though, and maybe Madeline, you've got an opinion on this, is you don't want to overmix all those colors you're introducing into either the shadows or the opaque. And that's where we get the mud. You know,
right.
You want to keep it fresh. You do want to keep it fresh.
When you have to kind of concentrate on your brush strokes and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And you can avoid that if you're doing a glazing technique. I did one portrait where I used like Aurelian, which is a yellow color, El Risen Crimson, and Cobalt Blue over Terra Vert to get the skin tones. And it was a lot of different glazes over it, but eventually I actually got flesh colors on it out of it just from mixing the different colors actually on the board.
Well, I actually have a comment on Kim's mud comment, because there were two interesting opinions from artists that I respect that deal with that mud. One of them being Donato Giancola, who, when he mixes his skin tones, he pretty much works with a pile of mud. And if you've seen his demos on a portrait or doing figures and he's doing flesh tones, he starts off with a pile of mud. And he mixes in every color on his palette together into a big blob in the middle. And he even calls it his mud pile.
Yeah, I think it's a different kind of mud pile than what they're talking about here, though. Because his mud pile, yeah, there's all the colors in it, but they're not all in the same spot on his palette. They're kind of all intermixing with each other. Mm-hmm. So he's got like a cool, you know, he might have a cool blue part of the mud and a warm orange part of the mud. But the fact that they're all mixed together, they're all relating and they do kind of, it's hard to say, there's a cohesiveness and a symmetry to all those different colors. And when he applies to the canvas, it looks pretty seamless.
And there's an important difference between working digitally and working in oil colors, because you're dealing with physical pigments, and so you're dealing with the optics of the specific pigments you're working with. I mean, it's like with glazing. Part of the reason why that looks so good is that you actually have the light bouncing through the layers, and you have the different grains of the physical grains of the pigments reflecting off the light. I think it was Vermeer actually used to use ground glass in their pigments just to make them brighter to get that reflectiveness. So you're also dealing with that. So when you're mixing these, you know, oil pigments, physical pigments, they're going to look less muddy because they're actually, you know, if you look at a burnt sienna versus a similar brown color that you mixed from more colorful pigments, they're going to have a different feel to them when you see them in person, because physically the mixed brown has more colors in it. You know, it's innately livelier because it's made up of a million microscopic dots of different colors.
There's another point I want to make as far as working traditionally versus digitally, as far as color selection. And a lot of it, when you're working traditionally, it might have to do with the manufacturer of the paint, or even the type of paint that you're using. But there's certain things you have to be aware of, and you get used to them over time, such things as drying time. Certain colors take longer to dry, like alizarin crimson. Certain colors are more intense. Like, I tend to stay away from things like Prussian blue and stuff because they're just too intense for me. Just a little bit of it just overpowers everything. So
do you
know,
like,
working digitally, you just, you know, select it from your little color picker. You don't have to worry about any of that kind of stuff.
So do you like a more muted color palette for your own work?
I don't know if you can say that about a lot of my work, but generally that's what I prefer. Lately I've been doing like a lot of young adult middle grade covers, and those clients tend to want me to saturate the color palette a lot to apply to a younger audience, which is no problem. I have no problem catering to the client if they request a certain type of color scheme or whatever. But I think my personal aesthetic is more of the muted color palette, and I think that to me, it's more powerful sometimes. Like, you look at some of maybe Sam Weber's work and stuff, and there's just, you know, the whole thing could be just black and white, but there's just like a splash of color somewhere. And to me, that makes it more effective. The color is actually becoming a subject in the composition, calling attention to something. Yeah.
Okay.
And Palancar, too. Like, John Jude Palancar, I love his work. And, you know, his is probably it depends on the piece, but it's definitely a more muted palette, I'd say.
Very much ochre, all the ochres, and yeah.
Yeah, that brings up a point that I wanted to discuss, and that was based on the client and based on the realm and genre that we're all working to paint in. Are people finding that they're having to manipulate their color palettes in order to fulfill the client's needs and wishes? For example, or if you're doing work in a movie versus a kid's book versus a fantasy book cover, what have people been finding with that? Like, I asked this because I've noticed there's a trend in movie making lately when it comes to fantasy and genre type of work, and that is that the color palettes that is being projected on the screen is very muted, very, it tends to be bluish and very old looking, which contrasts your kid's book comment.
I can't speak to that. I don't know why. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, perhaps that's more about the atmosphere or the mood that the artist doing the movie or whatever you're referring to, Mark, that it's more the mood of the piece. You know, definitely we're influenced by those cooler tones. Is that what you're talking about, that they're using things more muted and cooler and to convey the message of the movie itself?
I don't know if it's necessarily the message of the movie. It just, I mean, maybe it's just the realm of movies that I've been seeing lately, but they do seem to be more muted, more moody kind of tones in the color palettes.
Let me ask you this. Is it a mood that's carried through from scene to scene throughout the whole thing, or does each scene or chapter kind of have a certain look to it?
Well, I mean, if you take, for example, the 300. Now, granted, that was based on the pretty closely to the graphic novel, but again, you know, very muted, almost monochromatic type of palette to just the whole look from scene to scene. There's a new movie coming out called Centurion, which reminded me of the 300 in that it had a very muted, you know, look to the scenes. You know, if there's fire in a scene, well, obviously, you know, there's going to be orange and yellow colors, but there's this muted feel to a lot of these movies that I'm seeing coming out. I'm seeing it more in like our genre, the fantasy type genre, than, you know, other romantic comedies or something.
Maybe it's a steampunk influence sort of a thing, because it seems like things are tending to want to look older. You know, there's a real, you know, steampunk is getting so mainstream at this point, and that's all muted. You know, everything there is, you know, it's browner more than it is cool, but there's still that whole aesthetic where things are kind of faded and old looking.
I'll buy that.
Well, that's...
I really don't know. You know, it's interesting.
Well, I have a comment.
I would think it's more interesting to have different feels depending on, you know, what's going on in the story. You'd want a certain feel to it. Now, let's face it, in our culture, certain colors have different feelings about them. You know, if it's a very placid, calm scene, to me, I think in blues and greens and stuff. If it's a battle scene, I'm thinking reds and oranges. Yeah, to me, it's a little odd that they'd carry the same exact thing through a whole, you know, other than kind of keeping it a little cohesive. But to me, that it makes it a little monotonous if they don't change it up a little.
There has been a lot, particularly in television police procedurals, when you go into the labs and they're darker than anybody could actually do any lab work in. And they do tend to be very, very blue, and, you know, they're very cool colored, and they have almost no light, and they've even carried that into other scenes where people are sitting in a daylit office area, but they're so dark. And I'm thinking they did that a lot in Numbers, which Ridley Scott produced, which goes back to Blade Runner, which was also very cool and moody like that. So I don't know if that has any influence.
I remember catching some scenes of like medical dramas on TV, and it'd be so dark you couldn't possibly do surgery. You'd be cutting your own hand, you know?
Yeah. Fluorescent light, you know, makes no one look good.
No. And that's understandable. They want to make it look good, you know?
It's sexy.
But, you know, getting back to your question about clients maybe requesting a change in color scheme, I am currently working on a children's book, and you know, you want it to pull the child in. And Alan, you mentioned that your colors have been more saturated for young adult covers. And definitely the author wants things more light and pastel, thinking that they will appeal. And yet there are parts of this book where there is a sad event that takes place that I'm trying to introduce the more moody blues. You know, well, not the moody blues.
Moody blues.
More. Sorry.
It's a musical.
I'm a child. Yeah, it is. But anyway, I pointed her, out Chris Van Allsburg to her, showing how effective more monochromatic themes can be. And, you know, I am surprised how monochromatic he has been throughout his career and how successful that has been for him. So, but I'm sure the author will win out because she's paying me to do this. So, anyway.
Well, yeah, those monochromatic paintings are, I think they're some of the best. They're more interesting to me. Some, not complete monochromatic, but, you know, using color sparingly, I guess I would say.
Yes.
Uh-huh. But yeah, as far as the clients go, yeah, I'm more saturated for kids stuff. But I know, don't magic cards have certain like colors to their card? Yeah, I've never done magic cards, but I would imagine you'd have to kind of stay in the family of that color for the card. Does that make sense? Have any of you done magic cards?
Well, from the information that was provided from IMC about doing the magic cards, there was definitely a color schemes depending on, and I have to say I've never actually played magic, so I don't know the ins and outs of the whole game in and of itself. I mean, I've seen the cards, I've looked through them, I've seen the work that other artists that I know have done for magic, but I don't necessarily know what the color schemes are, but I have seen their style sheet type of things, and they definitely do have color themes that are pervasive through certain cards for whatever those are. I wonder if and that's. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Alan.
Oh, my guess is that you don't have to. I don't think they insist on a certain color palette or something, but just I think they do want it to relate to the color of card. I've never played it either, but that's what I imagine based on the. Probably the same style sheet you saw from the IMC.
Well, another interesting thing that I just heard from, I was at Dragon Con, and there was a panel on, I think they called it The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. It was about book covers, and Irene Gallo was on the panel, and also from Peer Books, the AD.
Is that Lou?
Lou Anders, that's it.
Okay.
Lou Anders was on the panel, as well as an author and one or two book cover illustrators. And one of the interesting things that Lou had said specifically was that until recently, brown book covers didn't sell. And that was kind of across the board.
I thought it was green.
Well, there could be green too, but...
I heard that at one point that green, for some reason, green didn't sell. I don't know.
But he was specifically saying that brown book covers didn't sell, and it's kind of a problem because most artists' favorite color is brown. And I don't know if that's necessarily true, but I know a lot of oil painters use a lot of brown, especially when they're starting to paint, you know, unless they're the postmodern kind of splashed color all over. But if you're traditionally academically taught painters do a lot of brown in their paintings, but Madeline had mentioned about the steampunk thing and becoming very big, and this was definitely evident at Dragon Con. There was thousands of people that had steampunk costumes on, and hundreds of vendors that were selling steampunk stuff. But there's actually a wave of steampunk-esque kind of covers that they had gone through at this panel that are going to be on some books, you know, in the near future to try to ride some of that wave that Madeline was talking about.
So are they all brown?
So, yeah, and they're brown, yeah?
They're all brown?
That's where you go if it's steampunk. You got all that brass and stuff and tin.
But you can throw a lot of other color in there just with the lighting. Stuff, which is what I would do to liven it up, probably. Because I think a lot of book publishers do want it to stand out on the shelves is the ultimate goal, so they want it something that will stand out. So I can see why.
But I think
monochromatic brown might not be the.
But there's also, I mean, if you're talking to somebody who's into steampunk, you're gonna look for the color brown.
Madeline, I think you bring up something important, and it's going back to, I think, Alan, was it you who talked about value, or yep. was it you, Mark, that said that it really doesn't matter what colors we use, it's if our values read strong, and our shapes, and really when you're thinking in abstract form, if that reads well to the viewer as you walk by, if it catches your attention, and that has to do with all of that balance of our values. And I think you could stick any color on top of those and still have it be successful. Do you agree with that or not?
Absolutely. I think in Dan Dos Santos's tutorial, he kind of reinforced that pretty well, that the actual color that you choose is the least important thing. When you go to your palette, the most important thing is value. The second mm-hmm. most important thing is the temperature of it. Is it warm or cool? Uh-huh. Third is how intense it is, how saturated or desaturated. And the least thing you have to worry about is the actual hue of the color.
You bring up a good a segue into color temperature, Alan. Color temperature can be very subjective, though. And that I think James Gurney had a couple examples, both on his blog and in some of his lectures, where he showed how the relative temperature of a color can be warm or cool and change depending on the other local colors around it. So how does someone who, you know, needs color for dummies, how do you get around that? How do you deal with that?
That's a tough one, because a lot of it is just kind of experience and intuition, because you're right, the same color could look, you know, let's go back to skin tones. If you can't paint, you know, the old joke is, you know, get the crayon that just says flesh, right? Obviously that doesn't work. Or whatever cues are coming from the environment will influence what that skin tone looks like, the light, the shadow, the reflected light off of the objects around you. So yeah, our, you know, what one color might work in one painting will look completely wrong in another one, even if you just change, you know, the objects next to the figure or whatever.
I think.
Well, that's just it. You can't tell temperature until you have two colors, right?
I would say that's true.
Yes, because you have to see what the colors look against one another. But I think one of the things that you can use that's useful is going into Photoshop with a reference picture and actually color picking areas and really taking a look at what that color actually is, because you always have to fight your perception when you're doing art. When you're trying to replicate something that's real, you always, and it goes to drawing as well as color, you always have to turn off what you're thinking and turn on what you're seeing. And if you mm-hmm. if you go into Photoshop and use the color picker and isolate a color, you can be really surprised with, oh, geez, this color is darker, or it's bluer, or it's redder than I thought it was. You know, because you could be working on a shadow on a face, you know, and be in completely the wrong ballpark, or, you know, be, you know, 50% off of what the tone is. Really easily. So that's, I found that really helpful just for learning, you know, just going in and sampling colors and seeing what they are.
Another very enlightening thing would be if you're working traditionally to mix what you think is the appropriate color. You know, say you have some really good reference that you're working from. You mix what you think is an appropriate color and then you dab that color onto your reference and just see how accurate it is. Sometimes you might find that you're just way off.
Actually, I forgot the name of this guy who teaches class, but he's got like a method for painting. And one of the tools he has, it's like a 50% gray card with a hole in it. And it essentially does the same thing as the color picker thing in Photoshop. It's like if you're looking at something, you hold up this thing that blocks out everything except the circle of the local, you know, of the color. Mm-hmm. And since it's 50% gray, it's completely neutral. And it mm-hmm. and it helps you, you know, actually realize what color you're seeing. One good way to check your value, and I do this just because the lighting situation in my house, is see how your painting looks in dim light.
I agree. Because, I've done that too, Madeline.
because it, you know, the thing is, the way my studio is set up, there's still some light leaking in when I turn the light off and go downstairs. And so inevitably I see the thing in half light, and then it really points out the values, you know, how it's reading value wise. It's a pretty good trick, I find.
Yeah, I've had some of that happen myself, where I had some pretty piss poor lighting in my studio, in my old house, and I used to have a clip light that I would attach to my easel, and it would provide a nice amount of light to paint from. But I noticed that it was generating hot spots, and I really wasn't identifying those at the time. But these hot spots were making the value of certain areas of the painting be much higher key than they actually were when I was working on them.
Yeah.
And like you said, when you shut the light off, it looked a lot more mid-value, the whole painting. And until you put that, you know, spotlight type of light fixture, you know, and to shine on the painting, it just looked very dark. And it wasn't until the piece that I'm doing right now, where I'm working in an area where the lighting is better, I don't have to have that spotlight on it, that the lighter values, I'm working lighter. And like you said, when you shut the lights off, you can still see the values.
Well, there's another good point. You brought up the lighting. When you're working with color, you have to really be careful what kind of light you're working in. You know, whether it's full daylight, you know, you can't just use an incandescent bulb. You know, you need to get a full spectrum bulb, if at all possible, if you're not working in sunlight, just to, you know, or if you're working only under fluorescence, get one cool tube and one warm tube, so you have that balance, because that's going to affect everything in your color.
Yeah, and it's not that expensive to set that up, because they make those lights to have, you know, the fluorescent ring around them, and then the incandescent one in the middle, so it kind of gives you the best of both worlds. You could buy a couple of those, because I think, like what Mark was talking about with the spotlighting, you want to avoid that. You want as even light as you can get, so, you know, buy a couple lights over your board to kind of even it out.
The real cheap way to do it is go to, you know, whatever, you know, lumber yard, and get a two fluorescent tube work light, which you can get for under $20. And just get one cool tube and one warm tube, and you're covered. You can even get full spectrum tubes that they use for growing plants and stuff. But I mean, if you know, like everybody's strapped for money, just get a two tube fluorescent work light for $7 and two fluorescent tubes.
Come on, we're artists. We've all got grow lights.
Speak for yourself, Archer.
Hey, you know,
but I
another
will be
thing,
stopping
though,
by your room during a LuxCon.
Another thing, too, that really helps kind of in this same category is making sure that the palette you are using has either a gray paper underneath it, underneath your glass. Whatever you're doing on your paper, your surface that you're painting on, make sure you're not working on a white palette, because you'll overcompensate.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a matter of personal preference, though. I personally like the white, personally.
Okay.
I just use
it. It has helped me.
You can. They actually make disposable palettes in 50% gray now, just for that reason.
Okay.
Haven't seen those.
For those who like sit on the fence.
Yes.
Okay, I do have a question for all of you. To use black or not to use black? I've been reading a lot of books that suggest that you darken your colors by using its complement.
Well, you can darken a color by using its complement, but depending on what that color is, you're going to get somewhere from the range of a grayish brown to an almost black, so it kind of depends.
That's weird, because when you add the complement, you're graying it out. I mean, that's how you can make a gray, is with complement,
yeah,
so you won't actually be darkening it. I can see where you'd use that in shadows, but you couldn't really use that if you really want dark.
Okay.
So I mean,
there are some complements, though, that will give you a very dark black, and they may not be exact complements, but like if you were to mix like an ultramarine blue with a burnt sienna or a transparent red oxide, which is in that orangish family, which is kind of the complement of the blue, you're going to get a pretty dark valued color. But it also depends on where and how you're using it. If you're glazing with it, it's going to seem a lot less dark than if you are putting it on more thickly.
I think as far as using blacks, maybe stay away from using black by itself. And I tend to mix in like blues and because I tend to work with a really limited palette. So, you know, I'll always mix in like some of my red and some of my blue to kind of there's if you can ever find this pigment, it's I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, but it's Caput Mortuum.
It's Caput, like,
oh yeah. Yeah,
that is a great shadow color because it's sort of this neutral purpley, slightly reddish, not really kind of color, and that's almost as useful as the violet gray. It's sort of the shadow equivalent, at least that's what I found.
Okay.
So that's something to look into, because it's not really harsh, but it does tend to work well in shadows.
I have always used a couple of the colors that Mark mentioned. I use the ultramarine blue and burnt sienna to mix my black, and then when I mix it on the palette, I'm conscious to mix a warmer black and a cooler black. So depending on what I'm working on in my painting, that's how I do that. So it gives me kind of both options. And it's not, I don't think there's anything wrong with using straight up black, but you have to know how to do it. You don't want it to kind of get in your colors.
Black's an interesting color because I remember when I was in grammar school, you could take black and mix it with yellow and get a green.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
it's very, very nice olive green. Yeah.
Yeah, so I mean, and that's not anything that you would expect from color theory, and that goes back to the individual characteristics of the pigments.
It was probably a cool black, so there was some blue in there.
Right.
That's why that happened, yeah.
Has anybody worked with limited palettes?
Yes.
Yeah.
So what
next question?
Can we, sir, perhaps share what those palettes were and what your experiences were? I'm sure people are interested.
Have you done that much of that, Alan?
No. I've always been a color guy, so I haven't really done too much limited palette.
Limit my palette?
Then.
Yeah.
Limit my palette? Are you mad?
Why limit the palette? It's infinite colors. Why would I want to limit?
Alan just removes black and white from the palette and uses him.
When I set up my palette, I definitely have certain go-to colors, but depending on my painting, I kind of change my palette.
So what are your go-to palettes? I think we need some specifics here.
Well, I've always got the titanium white. I've always got the ultramarine and burnt sienna. I always have either cadmium yellow medium or cadmium yellow light. They have kind of a different feel to them. Sometimes I'll have both. Then I'll either have raw sienna, or depending on the painting, if I want something a little more intense, I'll go with something like a Mars orange. Then I'll have my cadmium. Well, see, some of these colors might be manufacturer dependent. I'm not sure.
You can always go to the tubes and.
Yeah.
And they'll have exactly which pigments are in there. So if you want to compare pigments between colors between manufacturers, just go on the tubes and check what the pigment code is on it.
Then I'll generally have a a warm red like cadmium red, and then I'll have the cool red, alizarin crimson, then I'll have generally some sort of violet. That kind of depends on the picture. Sometimes I won't use violet. Greenish umber. Kind of depends on the painting. Like if it's if it's got a lot of vegetation and stuff, I'll use some of the earth, greenish earth stuff, some olive green, some sap green. Like I said, I tend to stay away from those really intense colors, like the Prussian green, Prussian blue, things like that. And that's about it. And then I try to have a cool brown, like raw umber. And I already have burnt sienna on my palette, but I might add burnt umber too, depending on what I'm doing. And then, you know, I might introduce some, depending on my painting that I'm working on, like my Lady of the Lake one that I did at the IMC last year. I used this kind of bluish green. It was kind of intense. So all throughout that painting, I had that. I forget the name of the actual color, but I had that on my palette the whole time. So like I said, I do have some go-tos, but I definitely am flexible with it, which I know some people kind of stick to the same palette all the time. Are any of you that way?
No. And the reason, Madeline, I've been using a limited palette is so that I can learn what colors do. And I read that in Richard Smid's book, and I've been doing those the color charts, and I've really learned a lot in doing those. They're sure a pain to do, but I've learned a lot about what colors do and don't do.
So what colors are you using on your limited palette?
Well, I began because I tend to like more of the earth tones. I have gone with the yellow ochre, the ultramarine, and the alizarin, and then the titanium white, but I haven't used any black.
Nice.
But I start adding things so that I can learn what those do. So my limited palette has been more because I'm just learning, and I imagine that there will be colors I will add that I want there because I have a specific purpose for it, like with Alan.
So have you done any paintings with just that limited palette?
I have. In fact, right now I'm working on one where I've changed up. I'm using a chrome oxide green, Venetian red, black and white.
Wow.
It's been interesting. And the black kind of becomes my blue.
Right. Are we all talking about oils with all these?
Yeah,
I am right now. Okay. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I only paint in oils.
Yeah. Well, there are other... Some people might prefer acrylics or watercolor.
I work in acrylics.
I know. Oh, do you?
Do you imagine?
Yeah. After the first IMC, I actually gave away all my oil paints.
You know, for me, it's almost... The grass is always greener. When I'm doing an acrylic painting, I want to use oils. And when I'm using oils, I want to go back to acrylic, so... I'll just kind of keep switching it up, I think. The one thing I don't like about acrylics is how they dry a little darker than how you actually apply them. Kind of throws you off sometimes.
Yeah, that threw me off when I first was using acrylics back in art school. And I couldn't figure out how dark something was going to dry depending on the color, because it seemed like the darker colors dried much differently than the lighter type of colors.
Yeah, they dry kind of matte, so they tend to... Feel a little lighter, yeah.
Yeah, I couldn't deal with that.
Yeah, I mean, you can bring life back into them later, but it's hard to kind of, as you're working, see it, yeah.
So Mark, what limited color palettes have you been playing with?
Well, I've used the most limited palette that I've used was a titanium white and...
Just that.
Just white.
I was painting a polar bear in the art.
It's hanging in the Museum of Modern Art in New York now.
But that's, yeah. Ultramarine blue and burnt sienna. And I had done a portrait with just those colors. And you actually get a pretty wide range of oranges and blues and grays, and you mix those two together, like we were saying before, and you get black. So you get a pretty wide range when it comes to trying to get some skin tone colors out of it. I've also tried some other little less limited palettes, like a alizarin crimson, sap green, white, and black. And that gives you, you know, some interesting browns, but it definitely, you know, sticks in that Christmassy kind of realm. But my general palette for general use, I've definitely not been as limited lately because I've been trying a lot of other colors, and I'm finding that I can still use brighter what I consider more garish colors and still keep a little more muted color palette on the painting itself. Like I would use a lot of yellow ochre, a lot of umbers, ultramarine blue, or alizarin crimson. I generally didn't use any cadmium colors on my palette. And I generally stayed away from black because I was able to mix, a very dark color with either raw umber, burnt umber, and an ultramarine blue, or burnt sienna and ultramarine blue, until I found Payne's Gray. Payne's Gray is really, really cool. It's a fantastic color.
So every now and then, blue black.
It is. It's very cool black, but it's a lot richer than like an ivory black, which tends to me feels a little dead.
Yeah, it's a little flat. There's actually one of the instructors at one of the conceptart.org, their big convention things. He actually, he was teaching oil painting, and his limited palette was yellow ochre. I think it was either Venetian red or red earth and Payne's gray. And that was it. And that seems to be a pretty useful palette, because I think James Gurney's used something similar to that too in some of his sketches that he's posted on his blog. Speaking from I'm sorry. Go ahead. Oh.
Well, I was going to say, James Gurney, he recently had a questionnaire on his blog. He just showed his outdoor box. You know, what do you call those boxes? Gorilla boxes?
Yeah. And are they Peshat or whatever they are?
Yeah, I've never known how to pronounce those.
It's French.
I take your word on that, Madeline.
Oh, I don't know.
But anyway.
Painting box.
Yes.
Cigar box. Cigar box.
And he asked what was missing, because he had just opened it up for an open plein air contest. And oh my gosh, I have forgotten something. And we were supposed to guess what he had forgotten.
What was
and
it?
It was white paint.
That's what I thought. I couldn't see the labels clear enough to see what was there. And I thought the one tube on the left was white, but I couldn't read the label, so I didn't know. So
that's I thought the same thing you did, because it was Permalba, and I use a Permalba white.
But I do.
But Permalba,
really, you guys like that?
They make all colors, though, Permalba.
I used to. My tube's so old that it's a little too thick for me now.
I've tried using Permalba white, and it was like trying to use toothpaste. And I just did not like the consistency of that paint. Personally.
Well, that's another point, is sometimes, even within a manufacturer, the consistency differs from tube to tube.
Well, and it's the age, and the age of the paint, you know, have you had the tube open for a while and did it leak or something, you know, because the oil will separate out and stuff. Speaking from the acrylic side, when I went back to painting in 2003, after my experience in college having been told that I had no sense of color, out of self-defense, I went to a very limited palette. I had, and these were all fluid acrylics. I used titanium white, carbon black, Hansa yellow, quinacridone, or however you say that word, magenta, and phthalo blue green shade. And that's mostly when I do straight acrylic painting, that's all I use. And I can pretty much get almost every color I want out of that. I don't tend to use bright reds, so that it's not really an issue with the reds for me.
Well, here's a good question for everyone here. Would you prefer to have a smaller number of colors on your palette? Now, this is obviously going to be for traditional work, not digital, because you don't have just the big spinny color wheel. but would you prefer to have a smaller number of colors laid out on your palette and mix everything you want, or would you prefer to have as many individual colors as you use?
I way prefer mixing, and there's a reason to that. If you pick a yellow, a red, and a blue, and go with that, and mix everything, you're never going to have clashing colors. You're never going to have anything that doesn't hold together color-wise, because since they're all mixed with the same three colors, they're all automatically related. And that solved a lot of color problems for me, because there's a lot less decision-making when you're mixing it.
I think you can have a greater number of colors to choose from, and as long as you still do a lot of mixing, you're still going to maintain what Madeline's talking about. For me, it's almost media specific. Like for oils, I'd prefer less. For acrylic, I'd prefer to have a little more colors to choose from. I don't know why. That's just kind of the way that I feel.
Now, Kim, with colored pencils, because you do a lot of color pencil work, right?
Mm-hmm. I do.
So you probably want like a million colors, because I find that when I work with pencils, I want a million colors in contrast.
Yeah, but that's, I'm trying to pull away from that, or at least get a watercolor base to at least apply my color pencil on top, because it, you know, Madeline, it takes forever to get a dark.
Oh, yeah. Getting the saturation is and then you have to deal with the waxy buildup.
Yeah. Well, if you're using Prismacolors, which I do love, but I do like the oil base, and you don't have to worry about the wax bloom on that. But
which the brand wax of, bloom?
You get a wax bloom.
Okay, what's that?
You know how, like, when chocolate, if it's been through temperature change, it's kind of white looking.
Chocolate never lasts long enough in my house.
Okay. Okay. What happens is it gets this like whitish ashy haze over it.
Okay, I've heard of that.
And that's the tricky thing about colored pencil. Once you get to that, it's really hard to lay additional stuff on top, right? Or
it is.
Kind of impossible. Yeah.
Well, yeah, it just does it. It won't accept any more color. Yeah. But there are different things you can do. You can use a fixative. You know, you can use solvents. So, color pencils are pretty awesome.
They are. Drew Struzan uses them in his work. He uses them. You know, all that wonderful white light that you see on those movie posters. That's all color pencil.
I had no idea.
Yeah, because he airbrushes the acrylics, and then he goes back over the whole painting, not just with white Prismacolors, but with all different colors of Prismacolors to get the details in.
He uses it just probably some highlights and like some line work flair and stuff like that.
Did you see his DVD?
No, but I did. I've seen him step by step article on him.
Yeah, he actually uses a lot of color pencil in that. I mean, he actually goes over the airbrushing that he did in acrylics, and he does all his defining of the details and, you know, putting in directional strokes on faces to get and stuff. He does all that in color pencil over the acrylic. It's pretty amazing looking.
Yeah, I want to watch that one.
So those color studies, what about them?
What a way to segue, Kim.
I have a question. Okay, I guess one, because really I am legitimately interested in this. Do you think, okay, what kind of mood do I want to create? What is the first thing that you have to decide before you determine what color studies you're going to even put out there?
Well, for me, I mean, working digitally is great for doing color studies, because I can just do different color schemes under my drawing layer. But a lot of it begins even before I shoot reference, before I do sketches. A lot of it is when I first get that job and I read the material and I let it percolate in the back of my head. It'll give me a feeling whether I need to do this intense saturated color or something more muted. And again, what I spoke to earlier about certain colors giving you a certain feeling, that might play into it a little bit. I don't know. that's kind of how I deal with it. And then I just explore different color schemes on a separate layer until I find one I like. Back when I was doing traditional stuff, what I would do is when I Xerox my big drawing for mounting onto a board, I would also Xerox one down to about the size of 8.5 by 11 and mount that onto a smaller board and do color studies in the exact medium I was going to do the finished painting. Just because I think the more planning you can do ahead of time, the better.
Yeah, I think like with any illustration, you have to consider, you know, the first thing is what you're trying to convey. And I think from that, everything comes from that. And so once you know what you're trying to communicate, you can select the colors that best get that message across.
I know that I've pretty much only been doing my color studies in like Photoshop recently because it in a lot of cases I'm so unsure of what the color scheme needs to be for a piece I'm working on that I'll use Photoshop to just totally experiment, you know, throw a color on, use the hue changing tool, you know, change the color temperature tools, just start moving colors around until something looks like it feels right, and then start working from that. And if I had to be doing that in oil, even small scale, like you were saying, Alan, it would take me forever.
Yeah, no, well, digital's ideal for that, actually. And lately what I've been doing is doing my whole underpainting digitally and printing it out large and mounting that down, and that just saves me even more time. I mean, I eventually just cover it all with paint anyway, but my whole map of what the piece is going to look like is there, and there's a lot less chance of you being steered astray when you have that much done ahead of time. It's not to say that thing, you know, happy things like Bob Ross again, happy accidents don't happen along the way, and I roll with them. But I think the more planning you can do ahead of time, the better.
Well, I'm going to toss out one last question here before we end up tying this up, and that is different color underpaintings. And mostly this can be brought up in the digital world, this can be brought into the oil or acrylic, probably not the colored pencil as much or watercolor, but you can use colored underpaintings for, you know, those three mediums, and there's a whole lot of different ways that can be done. Does anybody actually deal with any kind of odd or strange underpainting processes, like complementary underpaintings, or, you know, I know Alan does a lot of same color underpaintings.
Yeah, you know, now that you mention it, I should probably experiment a little bit with that kind of complementary feel. Like if you're doing like a predominantly blue painting, to use like burnt sienna underpainting, is that kind of what you're speaking of?
Right.
Yeah. I haven't tried much of that, but
I had seen this painting in San Diego in a gallery, and it was a painting of a winter night or something like that, and it was a city street, and the street, you know, the mood was cold, the temperature was supposed to be cold, but when I really went and analyzed the picture itself, it had this bright orange and yellow underpainting. And there were just little pieces of that underpainting showing through all of the blues and grays and stuff that were, you know, really setting the mood. And the spots that it was generally coming through were coming from inside the buildings. And it just generated this feeling of life and warmth coming from inside the buildings, almost like it was just permeating right through the walls.
I mentioned this before we started recording. I had done a oil painting portrait and glazing with using just Ellerison crimson, cobalt blue, and Aurelian, which is an old yellow pigment. And there's a traditional thing where you use terra vert underneath all the skin tones. So that's, you know, and that's a green color, and it actually works out pretty well. So that's a kind of a complementary underpainting thing.
And actually, since we learned how to preserve our sketches, and because I tend to do a lot of shading and detail in my sketches, I've been printing those out in kind of a greenish tone, kind of the terra verde or what, you know, that greenish tone, or maybe in the blue, depending on what I'm going to be putting on top of it. I've been experimenting with that. And so actually my sketch becomes my underpainting. And actually, Mark, you can do an underpainting with color pencils. Many people do. And really? They do it a lot. Uh-huh. They do it a lot like Madeline is suggesting. Say with skin tones, you would do it more in the green tones so that you're applying then the glazes or the color pencil on top of that. So you see through to that green, and it's supposed to make it look really a lot like flesh with the veins underneath it. So
I stand corrected.
There you go.
See? What would we have done without you today, Kim?
don't answer. Hey, I wanted to throw out something that, do you guys know who Howard Lyon is?
Yes, he was at IMC this year.
Yeah. Do you know him, Alan?
I met him at IMC, yeah. Yeah. I know his work.
I don't know him.
Get something. Why? When, okay. Because he said something that was very interesting. You can cut this out if you want, but I didn't know if you, because James Gurney agreed with him. He said, gray will take on the characteristic of a color's complement when placed next to that color.
Oh.
Okay.
So if you have,
I had never heard that.
So if you have red and you put gray next to it, the gray will look green?
Yes.
Interesting. I'll have to try that.
Yeah, and James agreed with him. So
I haven't really thought about that one, but I think that I've seen that type of effect occur without really thinking about it too much.
Yeah. It's kind of one of those weird things our eyes do.
Yeah. Huh.
So are we all...
I'm surprised I wasn't in Gurney's Color and Light lecture.
Are we
it's
all...
probably in the book. He probably took it.
I'm sure it's in the book. Yeah. Is, the book...
Is the book out yet?
No, it's November, I think, Madeline.
Darn. I wonder if it's going to be at a LuxCon.
I don't know if James is going to be there. I don't know.
I know he has advanced copies. I think he saw on his blog, so I'm sure he'll bring a copy.
And I think when you're trying to find your way with colors, it does help to just keep a few around and really work with force yourself to work with fewer colors. Just so, because then when you're forced to work with the fewer colors, you actually learn the characteristics of those individual pigments. You know, because like I said, traditionally the traditional pigments have physical characteristics, and the best way to learn those individual characteristics is with working with a limited amount of them, so you can really see what each of them are capable of. You know, in a situation where you're not using 10 different colors.
It's almost like doing a scientific experiment where you have your blacks and your whites and you bring in these very limited number of other colors to kind of see what they do.
Right.
Without a lot of other noise interfering, so to speak.
And
it's like a controlled test almost.
And you get some counterintuitive, you know, results, like, you know, black and yellow make green. Who'd have thunk it?
I have a good exercise for anyone who wants to try to get better at mixing their colors, and that is to get sheets of acetate and take some of your favorite paintings, obviously that are in color. You put the sheet of acetate over the top of them and try to mix the colors that are in any given piece of that painting.
That's wicked.
And put it on top of it.
That's a good one, yeah.
So are you recommending doing this at museums?
Yes.
I'm doing Mondrian.
I'm sure that wouldn't be frowned upon.
Well, you know, it needs to be a really big piece of acetate.
Don't mind me, Mr. Security Guard. I'm just doing some art.
It's all about the doing of the art.
And let's face it, that's the only way you're going to learn the most is to just keep painting and mixing and learning stuff over time.
Yeah, I had a teacher who said one of the best things that you can do is take your palette and walk around your house and mix up the colors of everything that you see in your house and just put it on it to see if it matches.
Not the curtains.
I wouldn't recommend it, but
leave the cat alone.
Thanks again for tuning into the Drawn Today podcast. If you'd like to find more information about previous podcast episodes or artists on the blog, please visit us at www.drawntoday.com, or you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. The Drawn Today podcast is a proud member of the Visual Artist Podcast Network. You can find more information about VAPN and other great podcasts on the network at visualartistpodcastnetwork.com. If you have ideas for new podcast episodes or comments for artists on the blog, feel free to contact us at drawntoday@gmail.com. Today's featured music is brought to you by Zoe Keating. Hear more of Zoe Keating's stuff at zoekeating.com. See you next time.